Modern society is on a course of self-destruction. Like-minded people, if they were to join together, could achieve something better, a saner society. But what distinguishes the minds of such forward-thinking individuals? I hope to give some insight into this while explaining a nihilist perspective on morality. Do animals have morality? An interesting question, because a domesticated dog knows that some things are wrong to do because it brings the disapproval of the mistress. And that reasoning corresponds to the first stage in Kohlberg's theory of moral reasoning. Later I will be explaining how nihilism is a philosophy only understood by individuals who are capable of thinking at the highest, the sixth level on Kohlberg's scale of moral development, which does not imply that there's unity of opinion at the sixth stage. In their wild state, animals don't learn moral behaviour. Only humans can teach them that, and that necessitates taming. Morality is something learned. Most people subscribe to a morality that is given to them or that they pick up through influence. The active nihilist questions all values and therefore does not subscribe to morality. As nihilists, either we make our own moral decisions, ones that we have figured out for ourselves and that are free from any pre-assumptions, or alternatively, some of us may be like wild animals who are so instinctively able to fit into existence that they never need to think in terms of morals at all. The way that an ant colony or a pack of wolves behaves does not require that they have morality. I question how possible it actually is for humans to remain uncontaminated by moral codes without having a defence mechanism of some kind. Nihilism is just such a defence. Morality is the product of the human mind. There's no right or wrong that's just out there in the universe. No ultimate truth about morality that is out there just waiting to be discovered. Religions say that there is because God, for example, is supposed to have made a decision about what is right or what is wrong. Often this is just handed down through the interpretation of priests. But of course there are various religions, and the people who adopt them or who are born into them have various ideas about what is right or wrong, and they have different moral codes. Just as religion is made by humans, so are moral codes. While most people are manipulated into holding particular moral views, they are at the same time encouraged to view themselves as individuals. They are kept away from a realization of their place in life's continuity, the chain of life from which they are descended. They don't place themselves and their lives in a historical context, nor appreciate their duty to future generations. The moral codes of modern society encourage the living of meaningless lives, where people are like loose driftwood in the tide. To have a meaningful existence, you have to know your place in this continuity, and from this comes the most solid grounding in judging what makes most sense for you to do. A morality rooted in observation of nature is the only one that allows us to be realists. A moral code defined by punishment has a developmentally regressive effect on a population. It is infantile. Using guilt, a negative force, rather than a positive motivational force, such as achievement, is unhealthy. The imposition of Semitic values onto the pagan Indo-Europeans reversed the healthy attitude which praised as good the man who makes a positive contribution in life. This holistic morality looked at actions, not in isolation, but but in the totality of their context and their results. If someone hasn't ever analysed their life, which very few do because it's the mark of a philosopher, then any ideas they have about correct behaviour cannot really be their own ideas, but be ones that they have picked up from outside. There are biological limits to what every individual feels comfortable doing, and the feeling that this is involved with is really a feeling of honour. Some people have a strong sense of honour whereby certain acts really make them feel uncomfortable and they would be disinclined to do them, whereas other people have practically no sense of honour, and the only thing that stops them doing anything is that just feeling like there would be a punishment at the end of it, or just whatever moral code that stops them. As this feeling of honour is an emotion, it can be harnessed by outside forces, and you can be influenced to feel guilty about doing certain acts, which makes you more likely to behave in an approved way. That's really the basic reason for moral codes that we pick up from outside. They're trying to do that to us and have that degree of influence over our feelings. While morality varies from culture to culture, it also varies within cultures. Class differences, religious differences, and ethnic differences all result in groups with different standards of behaviour that are formed into moral codes within them. Instead of following any moral code, it's more sensible to consider the effect that our actions have, and to ask ourselves whether that's an effect that we desire or not. So you could say cause and effect are as near as the nihilist should come to having morality. To quote Nietzsche, mankind can best be led by the nose by morality.
World. engulfing all humanity in their tireless domination, erasing the past and twisting the future. In ancient tombs, forgotten spirits will wither and die. And from the dust of these crypts there shall rise an entity, born of vengeful wings. And from his soul, beings will spew forth abominations of consciousness, who will corrupt and weaken the world, twisting dreams into nightmares, creating new pain, a suffering that will last forever, and curse our lives through all time.
In 1958, Lawrence Kohlberg came up with a scale of moral development. Kohlberg came up with some questions that he would ask to children in particular of various ages, and to try and find out the reasons why they answered as they did. The basic interview consists of a series of dilemmas like the following. In Europe, a woman was near death from a special kind of cancer. There was one drug that the doctors thought might save her. It was a form of radium that a druggist in the same town had just discovered. The drug was expensive to make, but the druggist was charging 10 times what the drug had cost him. He paid $200 for the radium and $2,000 for a small dose of the drug. The sick woman's husband, Heinz, went to everyone he knew to try and borrow the money, but he could only get together $1,000, which was half of what it cost. He told the druggist that his wife was dying and asked the druggist if he would sell it cheaper or if he could pay later. But the druggist said, "No, I discovered the drug and I'm going to make money out of it." So Heinz got desperate and broke into the man's store to steal the drug for his wife. The question is, should the husband have done that for his wife? A lot of you might think that the problem with this question is that it presupposes that we agree with medical intervention. But actually that's not relevant, because Kohlberg is just probing into the reasons given for the answer to his question and not the actual answers themselves. Kohlberg's intention was to make some kind of a scale where people's responses could be categorized according to the kind of reasoning that they used. So this is Kohlberg's morality scale. The children were then asked questions such as, did Heinz have a right to steal the drug? Or was he violating the druggist's rights? And what sentence should the judge have given Heinz? And the concern is, as I say, behind the reasoning for the answers rather than the actual answers themselves. This wasn't the only question that was asked. There were other dilemmas that were put to the subjects, just to make sure that their answers weren't connected just with that particular question that was asked in the first place. Kohlberg categorised the answers into six stages of what he called moral development, and these six stages were divided into three levels. These began with the most infantile of the moral stages, so this is level one, stage one. Obedience and punishment orientation. Kohlberg calls stage one reasoning pre-conventional because children do not think as members of society. Instead, they see morality as something external to themselves, as something that the big people say they should do. This is why I formerly mentioned that a domesticated dog probably actually thinks at this particular level of morality. They say you shouldn't behave in a certain way because it's against the law or because it's considered to be bad, and that's all there is to it from their point of view. When they're asked a bit more about their answers, the child may add that the consequences are important. So they will say that it's wrong to do something, but you get punished. There can be no doubt that many adults actually never get beyond this particular moral stage. When you think of the motives that are supposed to guide people who follow certain religions, say, for example, the Old Testament in the Bible, or Islam for that matter, it can certainly be argued that heaven and hell are like a bribe on one hand and a punishment on the other, and that the implication of them being this is that if you do the right thing, you go to heaven, and if you do the wrong thing, you go to hell, and those are the very reasons why you have to do the right thing. In a sense, it's really necessary for the religion to make you think that the only way you can possibly know right from wrong is because Big God has told you it. And Big God has told you what will happen if you don't obey the rules. So that's just like the most elementary moral stage that Kohlberg identified in very young children. In fact, if anyone following the Bible decided that you could have your own sense of right or wrong that was actually independent of what God said, then that would actually bring the whole structure of the religion into question and whether it was really necessary to believe it or not. As a little afterthought, I'd like to add that there could be considered to be other categories of people in this level one morality. For example, you could say that nihilists who are particularly hedonistic and psychopaths and even for that matter naughty children never really get beyond morality stage one because they're concerned with what they can actually get away with, and the only thing that prevents them from doing things that others of us would feel that what we're wrong in some way, dishonourable, is just that they don't want to do that because they'll actually get punished. I'm making a big distinction between hedonistic nihilists and the other kind of nihilists who you could describe as being more like heroic nihilists, who have actually got very high ideals. Now let's go on to the second of the six stages, which is called individualism and exchange. At this stage, the respondents answered in terms of what was in the individual's best selfish interests. But at the same time, this had to be balanced and justified by making the decision seem as if it was fair. For example, Heinz would be right to steal from the druggist because the druggist was trying to rip him off. This is still moral reasoning at the pre-conventional level because The children are still speaking as isolated individuals rather than as members of society. They see individuals exchanging favours, but there's still no identification with the values of family or community. Level 2, Stage 3. This is called good interpersonal relationships. In Kohlberg's view, this stage of moral thought is reached during the early teens. Now the children believe that individuals should live up to the expectations of both family and community. Love, empathy, and concern for others are now brought into the equation. Heinz's motives were seen as being good compared to the druggist's motives, which were seen as being bad. Some respondents felt that it should be the druggist who was sent to jail and not Heinz, who wanted to steal the drug, and actually did steal the drug. And very naively, they expected that the judge would share that opinion. That shows something about how people can have entirely misplaced faith in the law. This then is conventional morality, because it assumes that the attitude would actually be shared by the entire community. Anyone would be right to do what Heinz did. The next stage is Stage 4, maintaining social order. Stage 3 reasoning was only relevant where someone's actual feelings and needs could be properly assessed, and an attempt could be made to try and help them. At Stage 4, the respondent becomes more directly concerned with society as a whole. Now the emphasis is on obeying laws, doing one's duty, and respecting authority. At this stage, they think that Heinz's motives may have been good, but he should have been punished because that is the law. And how would it be if just everyone started breaking the law anyhow, just when they wanted to? What this shows is a stage approaching adulthood where people are equating the law with morality itself. But unlike the very young child who thinks it's wrong to do something against the law because it's bad, and just because it is illegal, at this later stage people are thinking in terms more of how it would actually cause chaos in society. So they're thinking less on an individualistic level and more from a point of view of society itself.
Stahl würgen mich in meiner Brust, ein Teufel feige, meinen Atem in seinem Schoß.
now we come to stage 5, which is in level 3, and that's post-conventional morality. Stage 5 is called social contract and individual rights. I would say that it's a minority of people that actually get this far, but they are quite numerous all the same. Very often people would just stop at stage 4, and quite often they would stop at a stage earlier than that, although Kohlberg likes to make out that adults go through all these stages. I think he doesn't really want people to be aware of the fact that some people really don't think like they do themselves at all. Stage five, is the level at which people actually start questioning whether society is fair or not. So at this stage, while they accept that rules are necessary in society, they are also aware that rules are not always a good thing, and that they can be used to make a society that's overly oppressive. Clearly, people at this level of morality are easily seduced by concepts of liberalism and democracy. But such people are not actually philosophers, obviously, and their view that they have adopted has come to them because of influences from outside of their own thought processes. Influences like peer groups, the media, and education, and just generally they've just picked up their opinions generally by getting a flavour of what is generally considered to be just or unjust. The kind of people with level 5 morality tend to be the sort of people that, for example, were they brought up in Nazi Germany, would fully embrace the ideology of Nazi Germany, or if they were brought up in communist Russia and Soviet Russia, they would have fully towed the party line there as well. But they would at the same time be feeling as if they had an idea of what a just society was. They wouldn't be just doing it because they felt compelled. They would have a sense that their society really was morally correct, and they would be sticking to the general consensus on that. So if the consensus began to change, then their views would change with it. But they wouldn't be the ones to actually break loose and begin to question things outside of the mould. The same people, if they'd been living in Britain or America during the Second World War, would have been fighting Hitler, and they would have felt that National Socialism must be wrong, although they'd never actually take the time, of course, to find out what the tenets of National Socialism were in the first place. Such people don't get any further than just trying to think very vaguely about what is a just society or not. It's typical of level 5 moral reasoning in the liberal West to believe that all life is sacred, or at least all human life, anyway. You have to remember that people at moral stage 5, for example, also have a higher intelligence than people who are at levels 4, 3, 2 or 1. But that, of course, is no guarantee that they'll have a more sensible attitude on any particular questions to do with society. If you take totalitarianism, for example, very few people on the morality level 5 will agree with it nowadays. Certainly they won't unless they're brought up in a totalitarian state. But you will find people at the lower levels of morality, like 1 and 2, who actually are much more likely to agree with it. And ironically, or strangely enough, you'll also find that that totalitarianism is something that is considered rather attractive to people who are at the 6th moral stage of development. This, of course, is just one of my own observations and not something that Kohlberg has particularly observed. Kohlberg himself had doubts about morality level 6 because he felt that there were really so few people that could transcend the levels below, and if there were any people, in his opinion, at morality level 6, they must be a very tiny fraction of the population. and anyone on a lower moral stage can't actually put themselves in a position of empathising and thinking in the same way as someone on a higher moral stage than that which they have achieved. And it's my view that while Kohlberg was right to identify that there is a moral stage above the fifth stage, that he himself couldn't properly identify the thought processes that would be involved in this sixth stage. Kohlberg thinks of the sixth stage as being merely a theoretical stage, but there were some aspects that he identified as being different from stage five, in that people at stage six are more independently minded, they're more likely to disobey unjust laws, and they've effectively transcended the shalt and shalt nots that are imposed on us by external influences. They consider that laws are valid only in so much as they are actually grounded in justice. And there's a feeling that you must disobey any unjust laws, at least in so far as it can be at all practical to do so. There's a noticeable willingness to commit civil disobedience amongst people who are at the sixth level. And I would certainly say that anarchists could be counted as being level six morality as well. Looking for an example of a level six personality, Kohlberg came up with Martin Luther King, to which I would say that Martin Luther King doesn't count because he was like a hyped puppet and more probably belongs at morality level one. If I was to give examples of personalities that were at level six, you can probably guess who I'm going to say. The Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, although I don't want that to be taken as being any kind of condoning of acts of terrorism. And the eco-fascist Pentti Linkola, two of the biggest heroes to nihilists today. Yes, and I'll go further and say that level six morality is the level that nihilists achieve. The nihilist certainly doesn't decide that something's right or wrong depending on whether you get punished for it, or whether it's the law, or whether it's what brings you approval from your peers, and, you know, isn't bound by fitting in with the expectations of family or society, or the need to maintain a social order that they themselves feel isn't in their best interests or just seems to be unjust. Time for a break.
Thank you.
Nihilists are not concerned with questions of virtue or morality in the sense of a moral code. We're really more concerned with considering the effects of our actions and concerned with whether those effects are going to lead to results that are helpful. We can't always assess this with 100% accuracy, but we're still trying to do our best. Someone can still be a nihilist if they do something that they realise will have an effect that isn't really the ideal thing. But I suppose we all have weaknesses, after all. I would say that the utilitarian view, that of the greatest good for the greatest number of people, is consistent with what Kohlberg identified as being morality level 5. The result of utilitarianism is that the vast majority of idiots are basically cared for at the expense of a diminishing number of intelligent people. The way utilitarianism is so indiscriminate ends up ruining everything for everyone. This kind of attitude contrasts greatly with the rules of nature. Some might say that nature has a kind of morality of her own, where survival of the fittest, which really means of the most appropriate, means that standards are kept up and it really results in life continuing instead of getting gradually worse and ending up fading out with a whimper. If nature does have any moral code that humans could extrapolate from, then the very basic idea of putting your own kin first must be the root of any such supposed morality. You could say that what is good for your own kind is the ultimate good, and what is harmful to your own kind is the ultimate evil. Those are the rules that are followed by all living creatures in the wild. Somewhere hidden in the instincts of all humans, the same rules are applying. But for some reason, humans seem to have gone off the tracks in their attempts to rationalise their behaviour, and now they prefer to follow rules that for the most part conflict with the natural rules of survival and try to escape the supposed evil of ethnic nepotism. There's no doubt that some moral rules really do make society run more smoothly. We have to admit that you do have to have some kind of structure, some kind of moral structure to society, especially since we've identified that only a small number of people are going to actually ever be able to evaluate the correct course of action, the way nihilists aim to do. Our attitude being one that can only be expected from a small minority, we have to accept that given that society is not going to realistically consist of like-minded individuals, it is up to an elite to actually provide those on a different mental wavelength with rules to follow. And it seems they would prefer it if you did as well. The way most people think is rather lazy after all, and it does seem as if they do want everything already laid out, like this is the rules, this is what you can do, this is what you can't do, this is what's good, this is what's bad, and they just simply have to adopt that. Only a small number of us are actually really affronted by the idea of being presented with a moral code that we're expected to follow. So in that case, if anyone's got to set the rules for the others, well, maybe that should just be us. Although I actually prefer the idea that we would leave the others behind and form a society of our own with people who don't subscribe to morality. Like Nietzsche's idea of selecting ourselves out from the masses and becoming a new people. Clearly you have to be in a position of power or authority before you can start changing laws and getting people to subscribe to the kind of morality that we would prefer that they did. So the thing is, it's very unlikely to be enough just to get a message through to people about how they should behave. It actually does take laws to be set or religions to be made. It's futile moaning about the prevalent morality. We can either do something about it and get into positions of power and change it, or we just have to separate ourselves from it as much as possible. As I say, there have to be laws against certain behaviours. That means that a decision has to be made on the rightness or wrongness of that behaviour. There's no getting away from the fact that laws will be necessary, but laws should be for practical purposes, such as to make society run more smoothly, and in that sense it might not be called morality. In practice, when there's a stigma attached to breaking certain laws, these laws become morally defined. Some laws nobody thinks it would be shameful to break, and other laws vary on the person judging it. It varies how justifiable they think any of those laws are. Not all legislation is the legislation of morality. And in fact, laws shouldn't be the legislation of morality. Laws should be the legislation of practicality. But for those who feel that breaking the law is wrong because of the disapproval it heaps upon the wrongdoer, legislation can only ever appear as being moral code. To such a mentality, anything that is immoral must be illegal also. Otherwise, it would seem to be permissible behaviour. So the degree of rightness or wrongness of something then has to be reflected in the severity of the law and in the punishment for stepping out of line. That being the case, all a government needs to do to manipulate public opinion on how acceptable certain behaviours are is to alter how much of a crime that behaviour is seen as being. Legalisation is seen as permission to do that act, making it seem no longer immoral. Even acts that many of us would consider absolutely abhorrent, and which are, in fact, illegal, if they were legalised, would send a message to other parts of the population that there is nothing wrong with behaving in that particular way. You can see from this how having a basic religion that teaches people fear of God and lays down the law might be the only way to control certain elements of the population. Funnily enough, we would see these people as being less moral than we are, and yet the people who are lower on the morality scale, as devised by Kohlberg, would have quite a different view on things. They think that they are moral. In their particular way of justifying things, they're convinced that they have the right way of thinking about it. And not only this, but they ironically see the rationality of those on the higher scales as being the ones who are in fact immoral. When you think about it, we all know that there are people out there who have less morality than you or I, because they have lower standards of behaviour. And these very people are no doubt of the opinion that the views you hold are actually the ones that are objectionable and immoral. People who are on stage one would actually find people who disobey the law and who give the reason that they believe the law is wrong to have really flawed moral reasoning. There's no way they could understand their position on the bottom rung of the scale. As far as they're concerned, you should always obey the law, and you shouldn't question it. Yet since these people are actually quite prone not to obey the law themselves, or to behave in a way that they know is immoral, or they feel is immoral, then they actually don't think that they're... The point is, they don't think there's any excuse for that. They know they're doing wrong by their outlook on the issue. So they would do this thing and know that in their mind that it had no justification. There were no extenuating circumstances. They simply had sinned. They don't try and justify their behaviour in the way that someone higher up might try to rationalise it. Because they feel they've sinned, they are then likely to feel as if they have to pray for forgiveness from God or throw themselves at the mercy of a higher authority. So to sum up then, what have we learned in this exploration of morality? We've discovered that a majority of people cannot escape from subscribing to moral codes, while a small elite are capable of viewing these codes rationally. And such people don't subscribe to any code of morality, preferring instead to look at cause and effect when judging how to behave, showing that we have an affinity with the laws of nature which have no rationalisation required at all. Finally, we have discovered that it cannot be expected to make someone whose biological limits of thought places them at levels 5 and below to grasp the logic of those who are higher up the scale. So, the only way for the higher group to influence the lower group is to explain matters to them, or rather dictate matters to them in terms that the lower group can grasp.